Save big during Labor Day at Lowe's. Get up to 40% off select major appliances. Plus, buy more to get up to an additional 20% off. Shop even more savings with 3 Stay Green 1 cubic foot vegetable and flower garden soil bags for $10. This Labor Day, take care of your home for less at Lowe's. We help. You save. Valid through 9/3. Soil offer excludes Alaska and Hawaii. Selection varies by location. Select locations only. While supplies last. See Lowe's.com for more details.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
In the decades of the 1930s, even the great city of Metropolis was not spared the ravages of the worldwide depression, and at times of fear and confusion, the job of informing the public was the responsibility of the Daily Planet, a great metropolitan newspaper whose reputation for clarity and truth had become a symbol of hope for the city of Metropolis. This is no mere fantasy, no careless product of wild imagination. No, you will believe a man can fly, or at least you did if you were around in 1978. And if you weren't, well, chances are you still felt the impact of Richard Donner's Superman, a film that didn't just define a genre, but redefined what a superhero could mean on screen. This one is personal, folks. Again, formative, foundational, a cornerstone of my love for cinema, and the reason that the Man of Steel will always be my favorite hero. I'm your host, Michael, and as ever, I'm joined by the Jimmy Olsen to my Clark Kent. It's DK. Welcome.
Gee, Mr. Wilson.
you got your first assignment, Jimmy. And, yeah, how you
my
doing?
My watch
anyway,
is giving off strange vibes.
Yeah, comic book Jimmy Olsen with his little Superman watch. Bless. Sorry, I couldn't think of anybody else. There's no real sidekick to this, but yeah, you can be Jimmy Olsen.
As long as it's the normal Jimmy Olsen and not, you know, some miserable duffer that gets off in the first 5 minutes.
Let's not even go there.
Yeah.
Yeah, we're talking about good Superman movies. Oh, sorry. Anyway, and swooping in faster than a speeding bullet, returning to the show and ready to channel either Lois Lane or Miss Tessmacher, depending on her mood, it's the one and only Sandy Evans. Welcome, Sandy.
Is Superman spelled with two P's?
Poor Lois can't spell to save her life.
No, she cannot, literally.
What are you writing? An ode to spring. How many S's in Massacre? Some of the humor in this is just quite good, isn't it? So anyway, regardless of that, without further ado, let's spin that globe and head back to Krypton, Smallville, Metropolis, and beyond as we dive into a movie whose legacy still soars. So Superman debuted in Action Comics number 1 in 1938, created by Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster, and quickly became a cultural icon as the world's first major superhero. Throughout the 1940s and 50s, he expanded into other media, starred in a series of popular radio dramas voiced by Bud Collier, the iconic Fleischer animated shorts and live-action serials. In 1951, Superman and the Mole Men marked his first feature film, followed by the beloved Adventures of Superman TV series from 1952 to 58, starring George Reeves. By the 1970s, the buzz on Superman had to do with plans for a motion picture that was being designed as a lavish, big-budget spectacle with top stars and state-of-the-art special effects. Alexander and Ilya Salkind, the father and son executive producers who had scored international success with the back-to-back hits The Three Musketeers and The Four Musketeers in 73 and 74, gladly announced that Superman would be one of the most expensive movies ever made. But the 1970s were tough. War, economic hardship, inflation, rampant crime, and widespread disillusionment even affected the entertainment media. The comics industry had collapsed and almost died, while Hollywood forsook escapist fantasy blockbusters in favor of social realism, with smaller, darker movies reflecting troubled times and personal crises. There was never more need for a bright, shining hero. Oh boy. In 1978, Superman saved the day again. It was one thing to satirize superheroes on the big and small screen, as had been done a decade earlier with Batman, but to ask an audience to take the subject matter seriously, you had to convince them that what they were seeing was plausible, if not real. The key to that, as director Richard Donner stressed time and again, was verisimilitude. It became a watchword on set, and Donner even had a sign in his office with Superman soaring over the word. And it underpinned the movie's famous tagline, "You'll believe a man can fly." While offering fun and excitement, it addressed deeply philosophical, even allegorical themes, depicting the ultimate superhero in almost biblical terms, embracing myth, lost paradises, a selfless savior, an overweening villain, and modern chaos. So, with that all dealt with, we've kind of given a brief overview of the history of how this film came to be, but on a personal level, I'm going to dive in and do what we always do. I'm curious to know what your first experiences with this film were. Can you remember the first time that you saw it and what your, you know, initial impressions were? And Sandy, I'll come to you first. You're the guest, so why not?
I have talked about this with you guys, but yes, my first time seeing this was in the cinema. I was all of maybe two and a half years old. I don't remember much, but I do remember being scared for my life. And it was when the opening credits had started. And I, just watching them now, I mean, imagining them bigger than life and the sound, you know, I've actually think they've toned down the sound in the in movies in general, you know, as opposed to what we experienced back in the 70s and 80s. But anyways, I was scared for my life. I just remember that much. And we did stay, though. My mother said she made me stay. And I don't remember that part. I don't remember what that entailed. But probably some very stern, teeth gritted, bared.
Look, we paid for these tickets. Yes. The text will be over soon.
Because it was a big deal to go to the movies back then. And then, you know, there were subsequent, you know, watching the film. I know it's something I've seen a lot, but not in a very long time. And so I just watched it again. I mentioned today most recently.
Cool. Can you remember anything about the rest of the film the first time you saw it? I mean, I know you were very, very young, obviously, to be kind of frightened by the text appearing on screen. But is anything else that stick in your mind, or is it just that, the pervading memory?
It's funny, fear is a pervading memory. And so the other thing I remember, and I don't know if it was the if it was there in the theater or shortly thereafter, but I do remember the car sinking into the fault scene. I remember that very vividly as being very young. I really don't know if it was from that theater experience or not, but that was just a whole other fear unlocked.
Yeah, fair enough. Cool. So what about you, DK?
I don't think I saw this at the cinema. I mean, it's possible, but if so, it's not a memory that lodged in there. I do remember watching it at home on video cassette. And you know, I'm talking Betamax. It was that early. And the majority of my memories are from watching it at home, either on the video cassette from the rental shop, which I do believe will have been rented more than once, or when it eventually came to TV, recording it, and it was just one of those staples, along with things like Star Wars and Wrath of Khan, Flash Gordon, that just got played in rotation over and over and over again. So, yeah.
Cool. Yeah, my story is similar to that. I mean, I wasn't born until 4 years after the film came out, so I didn't see it in theaters at the time. I have seen it since because they actually did it just last year. The 4K restoration actually aired at the local Tyneside cinema, so I was able to go and see it on the big screen. That was a kind of a bucket list thing that I crossed off because I like this movie. Spoiler alert. So yeah, the first time that I would have seen this would definitely have been on TV. And it would have been because of my mum, because she loves the Chris Reeves Superman films. Well, the first three anyway. She's not even that big of a fan of Superman or like into geeky stuff or comic book type things. She just really loves these movies. And so whenever it was on, which was quite frequent, you know, we've said it time and again, but this is one of those things that was, the first three Superman films were always on every bank holiday or, you know, Christmas or whenever anyone was off school, you'd always find it on one of the TV channels. It seemed to be a staple, at least in this country. So I know that whenever it was on, my mum would put it on to watch. And I'd seen it loads of times before I ever got into like comics myself as a huge nerd and then kind of came to Superman, the actual comic book character, I think. So this, weirdly enough, like I said, Superman is my number one, my favorite comic book character. And my first exposure to him would definitely have been this film. It wouldn't have been through comics or cartoons or anything. It would definitely have been this. So this is kind of responsible for that as well. I think that might be the same with a lot of people. I'd be curious to know, actually. Yeah, so that was definitely, weirdly enough, like I said, I remember watching it loads before I ever got it on video or DVD or whatever else, which I've owned since. But like you, Sandy, I can't remember lots about it, but there's one scene in particular that just stuck in my mind, and I don't know why. And it wasn't Lois's car thinking into the, you know, fault lines for me. It was the scene of the school bus almost tipping over the bridge and Superman rescuing it. And I've got no idea why that particular
similar vibes.
Yeah. And it wasn't because I was afraid of anything. I just thought it was really cool. And it was like, you know, like something sticks in your mind. And so whenever I was playing with toys and playing superheroes, I would always have like a toy bus hanging over a like a fake ledge. And, you know, whoever the equivalent Superman action figure was, like, I'll save you. I don't know why that in particular would stick in the brain. It's like a 2 second sequence and nobody really ever mentions it even. But that was what captured my imagination as a kid anyway. So. Yeah, obviously there's lots of other things that have since. There's tons of stuff in this movie, but yeah, fair enough. Can you remember anything that specifically stands out for you, DK?
It's the whole sequence with the helicopter that always sticks out to me, and the pimp going,
"Whoa!" That's what it feels like should have been, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Whoa, Jim, that's a bad outfit.
Yeah.
Oh man, the most stereotypical racist character just out of nowhere in a 1978 film. Oh dear. I gotta say, I do love as well the sly reference to The Adventures of Superman in that scene when he looks at the phone booth and it's no longer a phone booth, so he doesn't get changed in it. Like, oh, I love that little sly reference. I understand it now. I probably didn't at the time. Fair enough. So, yeah, that's cool. Well, before we go any further, I did want to say, this being a cinema classics, I debated which version of Superman, because there's at least three that we were going to cover, and decided that the best thing to do would be, I'm going to go over some of the things in the other versions very quickly, but primarily we're reviewing the one that came out in cinemas in 1978, because that's what cinema classics would be for, and the other versions, I think the very first one didn't come out till 2000, but if anybody's curious, I do have some information on these other versions, just because it's interesting.
Always curious.
Yeah, so the special edition is roughly 151 minutes, which is 8 minutes longer than the theatrical version. It is Richard Donner's director's cut and apparently is his preferred version of this movie. It is primarily used to refine and expand pivotal moments without disrupting the pacing. Those moments are extended scenes in the Kryptonian Council with more dialogue and a stormtrooper called to stop Jor-El. The train sequence cameo, which I've noticed is still kind of present. So basically when Clark in Smallville is running past a train, you discover that the little girl who sees him is Lois. And yeah, her parents call her out by name and say, "Oh, Lois, you've always been a dreamer." And her parents in that scene are played by Kirk Allen, who played Superman way back in the day, and Noelle Neal, who played Lois Lane in Adventures of Superman with George Reeves. They're still present in the theatrical version, but it's very blink and you'll miss it. So it extends their cameo, which is quite nice as well. There's a scene of a Native American reservation that Superman rescues from the quake. After the Air Force One rescue, there's a really good scene where Superman returns to the fortress and speaks with Jor-El. Extra scenes in the Daily Planet with one of Clark as a spectator watching Superman's rescue on the TV, and a cameo by Richard Donner, who actually says, "Oh, that'll be the day that a man can fly," is pretty amusing and meta. And then, as I mentioned off air briefly, there's a subway gauntlet, which I think is one of our favorite things, DK, that we remember.
Yeah.
when Superman has drilled his way into Lex's sewer lair, before he gets there, he endures machine guns, flamethrowers, and being frozen by ice machines while Lex just taunts him by loudspeaker. And there's more Otis comic interaction with Lex and Miss Tessmacher as well. But fans, including myself, would often note the gauntlet scene and the Jor-El talk as the standout additions from this version. I would agree with that. On top of that, there is also a TV/extended cut, which is said to be 3 hours long. It's actually 182 to 188 minutes, depending on random things like playback and such. This is the Salkind International version. It's been widely criticized by Richard Donner, who says that it was never intended to be seen. It was kind of an assembly, and it was a cash grab by the Salkinds. But I think it's interesting to see if you're a fan of those kinds of things. And being a lover of this movie, I kind of like having it, because I do have the Blu-ray when it came out. It reincorporates 45 minutes of unused footage, roughly, which is about 20 to 25 minutes absent from the special edition. But that results in a looser, more padded version. There are extended scenes of Krypton destruction, again, more prolonged, intense sequences, including an executioner and a terrified security guard. Clark's trek across the Midwest to the fortress, is shown in full. There's a very long 10-minute montage of Otis meandering around Metropolis and Grand Central. Lex's lair reveals that he has babies, what he calls babies, probably lions, that Otis is heard to be feeding, and that Superman apparently rescues Miss Tessmacher from being fed to at the end of the movie. There's some more flying Daily Planet scenes, rescue footage. But yeah, fans say this just feels like an assembly cut with many well-loved but pacing-hindering extras. So
you just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. With Indeed's sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Not necessarily the recommended or preferred version, but interesting if you get a chance to see it. And yeah, so have you guys seen either of these versions off the top of your head? DK, I think you might have seen at least one of them.
Yeah, I've definitely seen the extended one with the gauntlet. I'm not sure I've seen the TV version, which I'm kind of thankful for, to be honest, from the sound of
it. It's not that bad. I mean, it's a great movie and I like it anyway, so I don't mind it. I could sit and watch it for 3 hours and be happy with it. But it's something I'm glad to have, regardless. So,
yeah.
Although I do have a nitpick with regards to this as well, that on the 4K of Superman, annoyingly, the theatrical version is on 4K disc, but the special edition version is not. And yet, the Blu-ray is only of the special edition version, which confuses the heck out of me.
But,
yeah. Especially considering the Superman 2 4K has both versions of the film, the Donner cut and the Lester cut, on both 4K and Blu-ray. Anyway, that'll cover that bit anyway. So before we go any further, I always like to do a little bit of behind the scenes. And when I say I do, I always give it to DK to do when he's around. And DK, have you got any information? I think there's very little information about the behind the scenes of this movie, right?
Yeah, there's not much. It's just a trifle. yeah, I have some here. Just give me 1 second while I
go for it whenever you're ready. Yeah, because like I said, I know for a fact there's a lot of stuff about the making of this.
There was much speculation about who would play the Man of Steel. Stars mentioned included Robert Redford and Warren Beatty, but DC Comics editor Julie Schwartz was more concerned about the script. He recommended his friend Alfred Bester, a top science fiction writer as well as a comics veteran, but the Salkinds wanted a big name and signed Mario Puzo, author of The Godfather. The Salkinds told Puzo to ignore recent comics that had made Clark Kent a TV news reporter and make him a newspaper man, after a survey revealed that's how most adults remembered him. Oscar-winning actor Gene Hackman portrayed Lex Luthor broadly, which tended to undercut the rest of the film's demonstration that comic book material could be played straight. Marlon Brando, the other big name in the cast, was paid a then record-breaking salary of $3.7 million for what was basically a cameo. Superman's father, Jor-El, Brando brought dignity and conviction to the key opening segments on a crystalline Krypton designed by John Barry. Reportedly, Brando's participation also helped the producers raise a budget estimated at $40 million. Now, released in 1978, Superman was a lavish spectacle that ranged from Krypton to the wheat fields of Kansas for nearly an hour before the costumed hero even appeared. By its very size, the movie accommodated the fantastic figure of Superman and made him seem plausible. It had a lot of texture, said Christopher Reeve, who credited the Salkinds. What they accomplished by thinking big and coming in and spending money was that they set the stage for the film to be successful, because it would appeal to adults as well as kids. You could see it more than once and enjoy it, and it did get that repeat business. In fact, Superman was a huge hit, which was just as well, since during its production, a number of scenes had already been shot for a sequel. But yeah, that's a story for another day. So yeah, that's what I've got for the moment. I'll keep dropping little bits in here and there, Mike, but yeah.
Cool, excellent. Yeah, fair enough. So yeah, with that out of the way, then we'll jump into the kind of the full breakdown that we usually do, where we go in little sections like writing, directing. I've said this multiple times. If you're listening, you're probably sick of hearing it, but you know, acting, VFX, etc. And if the conversation flows a different way, we'll go with it. Again, you've heard me say that 100 times. But so yeah, we'll start with the writing and plot because that's what's first in my notes. I do have one brief thing to say before we jump into that, but I tell you, I'll ask you first, DK, in case it's the same thing you have. Do you have anything about the writing, BTS, that you wanted to...
I mean, we've already mentioned Mario Puzo was hired as the writer to give the script additional credibility. The characters of Non and Eve Tessmacher were not featured in the comics at the time of production and were created by Puzo for this film. Now, his script proved to be too epic and too expensive, so the team of David Newman and Robert Benton was brought in to hone him down. Benton was committed to directing The Late Show, so Leslie Newman, David Newman's wife, came on board, mainly to write Lois Lane's dialogue. Their rewrite was more campy than Puzo's and even included a cameo appearance by Kojak, the popular TV detective.
Yeah, fair enough. Absolutely. I had more or less the same thing, except that it's notable that Donna didn't like this version of the screenplay that had already been through Mario Puzo, Robert Benton, David and Leslie Newman, and hired quote-unquote creative consultant Tom Mankiewicz, who, depending on what you believe, may have been largely responsible for a huge amount of this script. But by that point, it had so many writers that that's his official credit. And yeah, in that case, it resulted, like I said, because of the multiple screenwriters, resulted in a film that is part epic sci-fi, part rural nostalgia, part rom-com, and part pop parody. And yet, you know, somehow kind of works, I think, which is going to be the first question that I'm throw open to the group. And I'll come to you first, Sandy. Do you think these various things all mesh together, or do you find there's any kind of tonal whiplash when you're watching this movie in the various scenes, the way that it cuts from Krypton, Metropolis to Smallville at one point, and the way that it has comedy, but it also has gravitas, I suppose, to it, romantic scenes. Anyway, yeah. What do you think of it?
Yeah, I think it does all mesh together quite well. In fact, I didn't even ascribe any sort of title to any of the different aspects of it. I just, you know, took it as a whole, and I thought it worked together fine. I did have a BTS writing question, though, because I thought it was interesting that they introduce the villains of Superman 2 in the very beginning of Superman 1. And was that, I was just curious, was that intentional because they knew they were shooting Superman 2 back to back, or was it meant to be explored more in the first one? Or I was just curious about that, because that's really unique.
It's something I would get into when if we ever reviewed Superman 2. But yeah, there's a whole lot of let's say a shit show to be polite when it comes to this, because originally the plan was to film Superman 1 and 2 back to back as one long shoot, in much the same way that you might know that they did like the Lord of the Rings trilogy recently ish so that they weren't intended as separate things. It was all going to be one thing, and that's what that's why we ended up ultimately with two versions of Superman 2 nowadays. There's the version that was released theatrically, and there's the Richard Donner cut, because Donner was actually fired from Superman 2 by the Salkinds. But because the films were being filmed back-to-back, apparently something like 70% had already been filmed. So, Richard Lester was brought in to direct Superman 2. Did you have something about this? Sorry, DK.
No, I was just going to say, they did a similar thing with the Salkinds had done this previously with the Musketeers movies, the first two. they'd filmed those back to back, so that when it, you know, so that when it got to the end, it had one of those Back to the Future 2 type teasers for the next movie.
Yes, yeah. I was just talking about this with DK, actually, because this might interest you to know. Yeah, the point of introducing the villains was entirely to set up the sequel. And in the Donner Cut, you can see their original intention of the script in that this Superman 1 would have actually ended with Superman saving both of the missiles from ever detonating. And one of the missiles that he threw into space would have been responsible for hitting the Phantom Zone and freeing those three criminals, which would mean that Superman 1 would have ended, as DK says, with the call, like, we are free now to conquer Earth. Okay. To be continued kind of thing. The actual world spinny changing time backwards thing was intended for the end of Superman 2, but they actually brought it forward to the end of Superman 1 and changed that around. And that meant that when Superman 2 did come around, the Richard Lester version does have to end with Superman giving Lois Lane a memory wiping kiss because she has to forget learning his secret identity, which obviously would have not been an issue had it, you know, turn back time and everything to the point where the, you know, the criminals would never have been released and laws would never have been told, etc. Absolutely fascinating stuff. If you get a chance to check out both versions of Superman 2 and all of the behind the scenes drama regarding it, I say absolutely do it, because yeah, bizarre what happened. But yeah, there's lots to say. And as I said, if we ever did Superman 2, which I kind of hope we do someday, I'll get into all of that. Absolutely. Yeah, anyway, does that answer your questions?
It does, and that was really interesting. Yeah, you're right. That is something I'd probably want to look into.
Yeah, for sure. Anyway, moving on, because we're not talking about Howard. So, yeah, what about you, DK? How did you feel about, do you feel that the story, the writing, the way that it is, does it mesh together for you, the way that it's kind of a combination of everything and even the three-act structure of Krypton, Smallville, Metropolis?
I think it meshes really well. It's it never... I don't think, anyway. I never suffer from tonal whiplash. I mean, it's got its fair share of tragedy. It's got its fair share of heartbreak. It's got its comedy. But I look at that. It meshes well. It's kind of like life. There's not really any kind of tonal change where it goes, okay, this is the serious part now. They all have their little highlights, and yeah, I think it works. I think it works really well.
Yeah, I mean, it's jumping ahead a tiny bit, but I think credit for that, I think, has to go to Donner as the director, because, like I said, the script could potentially have been a mess the way that it combines all these things, but I think it's his hand at the rudder that basically makes it all seem like part of a whole. And like Sandy says, if you didn't know that there was multiple writers or that it was, you know, various different things, you wouldn't necessarily even think about it. It would just be like, oh, no, it is what it is.
And yeah,
it flows quite well.
You wouldn't think that there'd been so much crap going on behind the screens.
No, definitely not, no. So the next point that I had about the writing then is that Superman himself kind of doesn't really appear until nearly an hour into this movie. Obviously, you do get, you know, baby Kal-El and you get young Clark Kent, which I think is Jeff East, but overdubbed by Christopher Reeve, if I'm not mistaken.
That's correct,
in the Smallville scenes. Yeah, I thought so. But yeah, the fact is that it tells you all of the origin and goes through all of that, and so... Do you guys think that the script earns that kind of thing? Is it rewarding when Superman finally appears, or do you think it takes too long before you see him? And DK, I'll come to you first, because I didn't last time.
No, I love it. I love that it takes its time, and you get to know the character of Clark and his upbringing, so that by the time it does get to Metropolis, and you finally see that brief section in the fortress immediately prior to Metropolis, that you kind of feel like, oh, here we are, here we go. But yeah, up until that point, I love that they delve into his background. I love the whole, you know, the fact that he's treated as a bit of a joke by his classmates. You know, they introduce Lana Lang, which they didn't really need to. You've got the whole thing with his parents, which I think really, really works, because it grounds him. You have that human element to it, and you grow over that period to care about Pa Kent just as much as he does. So when Pa Kent, you know, eventually goes, it's devastating. So
I will say as well, I could be mistaken about this, but in my research I did find out that the idea that Pa Kent dies when Clark is young wasn't, I think, part of the comic story, and was only like invented for this film, and yet has become so part of that lore now that it goes to show how influential this film is. And it is so vital to the idea of, like, I have all these powers and yet I couldn't save him from natural causes, kind of thing.
It does. It teaches him that humanity much more than, you know, standing by a roadside watching somebody get swiped up in a hurricane. But yeah,
not bringing it up. Yeah, we don't talk about it. It doesn't exist.
I love it. It gives a background, and it gives a lot of background that you don't necessarily need, but it does it in such a way that it never feels too much to me. I mean, you have the whole thing with General Zod, which, you know, sequel aside, you wouldn't even consider having anything to do with it. But it has that, you know, as Donna said, very similitude. It makes it feel like a living, breathing world. And I do like that about this. So, yeah, I think I think taking the time, especially, as you say, it was one of the foremost, you know, prior to this, I think the only thing that we'd really had were things like Flash Gordon, you know, the old Buster Crab ones, and the Adam West Batman. So they're approaching it this time as a serious movie. And I think it helps sell that, because it's not just, you know, someone in tights doing that. There's some real human drama. And I think it's earned.
Yeah. And I will say as well, I love personally the way that it kind of makes the Superman backstory so mythic and so big. Religious allegories aside, because we'll deal with that in a minute probably. It's in the comics, it was always like two squares of like strange visitor from another planet, his planet exploded, he was sent in a rocket ship and he arrives. And they never really go into what kind of society Krypton is, or how tragic that was, or the idea of Jor-El and Laura sending him and how they must have felt about it. And I mean, I know it's only 25 minutes at the start of this film, but it makes it feel so much bigger and grander, and really gives that backstory a lot more than just a couple of throwaway sentences to get him to Earth.
Yeah.
Did you agree with that, Sandy? Do you like the kind of scenes on Krypton at the start of the movie?
I did. Just to, like you said, just to show where he came from. And there was some exposition there that was important. And then I liked the whole, you know, growing up on Earth, kind of giving him a reason to even care about the humans, because otherwise why would he? And then how he came into his powers kind of after he kind of went up the mountain, so to speak, and what was it, 2 years he was there?
I can't remember. I do know that he was he's very pointedly said that he's 30 years old, because it's a sort of very allegorical to Jesus going into the wilderness kind of thing. But yeah,
you just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Yeah, so I thought that was interesting. Just kind of almost like... Not that it made him grounded, but that the purpose was for him to be grounded. So, yeah, I thought that was all very important, building up to the actual reveal of the Superman from the comics.
Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, there's a lot there. I mean, we kind of touched on it, but I love, again, like you were hinting at, the idea that we know the importance of humanity, that it's Clark's human parents that instill those values. And so we get a lot of the very Norman Rockwell-esque, again, we'll probably talk about it more in direction, but the very Americana, you know, what's the word I'm looking for? Like Kansas State, you know, very lovely golden hued, you know, typical nuclear family-ish type of thing. But yeah, there's a few nice scenes of his father, like saying, you know, you were here for a reason. Yeah, moving to the next thing, I have to kind of talk about something which is often cited as a divisive moment, and I can kind of see why. We're going to leap straight into it. The Lois Lane voiceover and little poem during their first flight. Do you think does it work? Is it awkward? Does it spoil the film? Does it enhance the movie? Sandy, I'm gonna come to you first on this.
Awkward.
One.
In fact, it makes me so uncomfortable. I actually fast forwarded through this in this viewing because I knew I wouldn't miss anything. I knew the overreaching thing was, like, she really did wonder where his powers ended and if he would be truthful about it. Like, maybe he could read her mind. He could do so much else with his X-ray vision and so forth. And it was just very uncomfortable. Yeah. And too long.
You read my mind. Too long. Do you know what you mean to me? You belong in the sky.
Yeah, it was a bit much. I didn't hate the idea. I just hated the execution.
I don't mind it. It's such an overly schmaltzy-ish type scene anyway that I just lean into it because it is kind of that. You know,
I did read that she was meant to be singing something.
Oh, wow. Yeah. I did not hear that, but yeah.
Yeah.
And so this was the better version.
Yeah. Donna did not like it, so changed it just to the voiceover.
That seems like a wise decision. So what are your thoughts on that particular scene then, DK?
It's cheesy and it's, I don't know. I just think 70s man.
It's 70s man.
Yeah.
That's a bad outfit.
Yeah. It's there. It gets her emotions across. It gets, you know, her thoughts across without going into exposition in other areas. It's all right. Like I say, yeah. It's just cheese. It's just cheese, and I can cope with a bit of cheese.
Like I said, I don't mind it because it's at that point where it's super heightened romantic anyway, because they're out on the flight. Although I don't think it's necessary, because I think the chemistry in that scene beforehand, the kind of interview scene, is off the charts anyway, frankly. So, you know, even the little flirtatious, like, do you like pink kind of moment is, you know, it's a little iffy, but still kind of cute, I guess, in its own way. So, yeah.
His bodily functions.
Yeah, exactly. Do you eat? Well, yes, I do when I'm hungry. Love it. Yeah, so anyway, talking as we kind of were about Lois Lane. I mean, it's 1978, so feminism is on the rise, but not, you know, necessarily as hefty as it would become. Do you guys see Lois as kind of a feminist or more of a flawed icon? Because obviously she's sharp and fearless and, you know, she can kick butt and that we could see that, but she also very much serves as the swoony, romantic, oh, fall into your arms type. And as we kind of alluded to again off screen, she can't spell to save her life, which is a bit of a shame to try and portray for a professional, you know, reporter. DK, I'll come to you. Why not? And ask you about this.
Yeah, there's only one P in rapist.
Exactly, yeah.
It's, I don't know. I like Margot Kidder is forever going to be my Lois Lane. And it's due to the fact that she is kind of this world-weary metropolis girl. And, you know, she does kick ass. But she does have that, you know, gentler side to her. And I'm sure, you know, these days it's going to focus less on that gentle side to her. But, I think it just shows both facets of her personality. And I like it. I've never seen anything, you know. Yeah, she is a bit of a damsel in distress, but, you know, again, it was the 70s.
I wouldn't say that. I wouldn't say damsel in distress. I would say it's just a little bit, like I said, swoony love interest kind of thing. But I think that's more, you get away with it because there's chemistry between them. So I think there's a little bit of that from, kind of Clark slash Superman as well.
I'm sure there's arguments to be made on both the feminism and anti-feminism side to how she portrays it. But I think she walks that line quite well in this.
In any case, it was certainly a lot more feminist than firing her from the third movie and replacing her with Annette O'Toole because she wanted more money. So, anyway. So, what about you, Sandy? How do you feel about Lois Lane as a feminist icon? Is she something that appeals to you, or is there flaws there that you can't get past?
I think it's appealing because she was very much a go-getter. She was pushing herself into the office, pushing herself on her editor, not taking no for an answer, you know, just very ambitious and worldly, even going out to cover Native American topics, indigenous people, and speaking to them herself. And yeah, so
she said
she's
gonna, she says at one point she's going to hold the president accountable. And because she's covering the landing of Air Force One, and she's like, and I've got some questions for the guy. So, you know, that's, she's right, better reporter than 90% of current U.S. reporters, apparently.
That's right. So, yeah, I didn't have any problems of, you know, even Given that, you know, scene of them flying, you know, she accepts it and is very curious. I thought she was, it was a really good role, I felt. And I felt as a movie, they did their best to balance it out. Like, even Miss Tessmacher wasn't stupid. And even though she played a little bit floozy for Gene Hackman, or for Luthor, but she wasn't. And she even got her, not that I agree with it or think it was good as far as consent goes, but they did their best to balance it out when she stole, you know, that kiss. That was 1978 way of trying to be balanced and fair to women.
Yeah. And I mean, it is telling that she doesn't end up in jail at the end, but he does drop off Lex and Otis, you know, so she kind of gets away with it, so to speak, because she came around and saved him in the end and did good, even though it was mainly for her mum in Hackensack, New Jersey. But yeah, so that actually leads us to my next point quite nicely, because I was going to talk about Lex Luthor's villainy and the kind of comic relief. It's weird because I feel like, in phrasing this question, it perhaps sounds like I'm criticizing something that I don't have an issue with, because it feels like it shouldn't work that Lex is both like bumbling and comedic in those scenes. Not just Lex, but like all of the, you know, all those scenes are played very much for laughs. And yet I still think there's menace there and there's villainy, and it is kind of threatening for me. But I don't want to put words in you guys' mouth. Do you think the kind of comedic dynamic with these three works, or does it undercut the stakes of things? Sandy, I'll ask you for this.
I think it works, and I enjoyed it, especially when his fool Otis messes up the missile, inputting those coordinates for the missiles. Miss Tessmacher has to go in and fix it, and she does so quite well. But he's, you know, maybe more book smart, and you can see that they maybe tried to portray him as someone who is, you know, well-read, but perhaps actually a bit stupid. But that's actually a very menacing combo. You know, that's actually most of our even real-world villains have that dynamic within themselves. So, yeah, I think it really does work. And then the comic relief, it was actually really good. I found myself even now still laughing at some things, both intentionally funny things and some unintentionally funny things. But yeah, in my opinion, it did work quite well.
Yeah, it's a shame that we've now lost Gene Hackman and Ned Beatty, because I think they're both great, even though they, you know, like, it's played for a comic relief a lot of the time. And I do remember showing this film to other people that haven't seen it in a couple of occasions, and that's something they came away with as a strength, was that I really liked the comedy. And it worked. It didn't really ruin the movie or anything. It actually was a highlight for them. So is that something that you can understand and see, DK?
Yeah. I think the dynamic of the villains works. They are comic relief, but there's such a layer of menace.
They're effective.
Yeah. Yeah, to Hackman, that just beneath the surface, for all his, like, you know, for all the bumbling, you know that this guy is serious. And he might have at least one idiot around with him. And, you know, it might play on that, but he is deadly, deadly serious. And I think that if anything, rather than him sitting there looking all Mr. Burns-like throughout the entire runtime, I think it makes him look even more evil, because he can go from, you know, this kind of humour to villainy at the drop of a pin. He's not quite as predictable as other variations on Luthor that I've seen.
I don't think it's my favorite version of Luthor, but yeah, sorry, you were saying, Sandy.
It's almost like a Bond villain, though. Like, his idea is so big, so huge.
Yeah, well, not really, when you think about it. I mean, it is but it's also kind of simplistic in its way, and in a way that you can kind of appreciate, like, oh, okay, I can kind of see what you were doing.
Break off a chunk of the United States.
Yeah. People that are critical of this version of Luthor will say that, like, oh, he's just a real estate mogul, and that's his threat. It's not like, you know, conquering the world or trying to kill, you know, Superman or whatever. It's more just being out for real estate.
But oceanfront property.
Yeah, oh, exactly. But then, having said that, I think, without getting too far into it, I think in 1978, how could we possibly have realized the idea that somebody could be an extreme narcissist, just to try and accrue power just because they were kind of making good real estate deals. And, you know, it was almost played for laughs because it was like, nobody can possibly think this highly of themselves and yet be, and yet look where we are now, you know? So,
yeah, but in fairness, Luthor was a genius.
I love his lair too. Oh my gosh.
That is brilliant. Cool.
Oh, yeah. I love that. Yeah. And I mean, he has a point when he says to Miss Tessmacher, you know, people are shelling out a fortune for stuff in the same location, but just a few feet above. So, but yeah, it looks so cool. The little converted subway station thing that they've got going on there. I'd live there. I love it. probably isn't so good when the trains go past. Like, it's probably noisy as heck most of the time. But, you know, anyway. So, yeah. The next thing I was going to talk about, like I said, very briefly, is that you can't really get through it. There are literary and mythological influences, and a lot of that feeds into religious allegory. The creators of Superman are adamant that this is accidental when it comes to Superman, because they're both famously, you know, practicing Jews. So they did not write Superman as a Christ allegory. But you really can't get past the idea that Superman is, you know, the one son that was sent to Earth by a wise dad figure to try and lead and be the light to humanity. And yeah, it's kind of there for you already. And I think this movie does kind of lean into that, and kind of, for better or worse, enhances that. The idea of Jor-El as a godlike figure and Kal as the messiah figure, it turns up in the Fortress of Solitude dialogue scenes, but there's also things like when Jor-El's initial silhouette appears, it's basically God. It has the full beard and stuff that Brando doesn't have, so it's like they're doing it on purpose. And I already mentioned the idea of Jesus's pilgrimage returning at age 30 is alluded to, and even Superman's ship, which was always the very traditional kind of cigar-shaped rocket ship in the comics, is basically the Star of Bethlehem in this movie. You know, there's no reason why it should be star-shaped other than to try and make that imagery pop, I guess, a bit more. So, yeah, do you guys see these things, or am I reading too much into it, DK?
I absolutely see these things. Sorry.
Yeah, I guess you can see these things in it, yeah.
Yeah. Do you think it's deliberate or you know, do you think it's just accidental, maybe?
To an extent, it could be, you know, what we read into it going forwards. But
yeah,
I don't know. The cell times are always a little, are they or aren't they? So it's that's for someone much more more equipped to answer.
But yeah, speaking of kind of, you know, similar to that, the legacy and influence of this movie. Do you guys think this movie established the modern superhero blueprint? The idea of an origin, a romance, a villain plot, you know, potentially the three-act structure, the idea of showing you. We kind of got sick of origin stories, but this did show you it, even though most people already knew Superman's origin. It took the time to enhance it and show the importance of it. So, yeah. And how has this influenced later scripts? Can you think of anything off the top of your head as well, if it has? And DK, I'll come to you first. I don't know why.
I think it's been hugely influential going forwards. You know, to the extent where often they do get the same actors that appeared in these to go in other films. Yeah, I think it's hugely influential. I think it pretty much solidified what superhero movies should be for a while. And I mean, when you look at, you know, just 10 years later.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Peter, with Warner's take on Batman with Keaton.
Yeah.
It might go about in a roundabout way, but it does lend it that kind of gravitas. It doesn't lean too heavily into it as it does in, you know, later films like The Batman. But yet again, it's not your old Adam West thing. It takes the subject matter seriously. And I think if not for Superman, Batman wouldn't have gone down that that street, and it certainly wouldn't have proliferated into, you know, the ubiquitousness of superhero movies that we are now. Some to obviously a lesser extent, because, you know, if you're going to compare things like Doctor Strange and freaking Halle Berry Catwoman, there are different ways to approach it. But I definitely think this was the template going forward, and not just for the movies. As you say, there are elements that have been taken from this now that pretty much are solidified, for want of a better term, however solidified you can get with DC Comics, but into canon.
completely.
Yeah, they all kind of have this touchstone, and I think this touchstone is this film. I mean, when you look at it, the entire S symbol on Jor-El for the House of El, that was through this film, and now it's in the comic books and everything.
I have to say, by the way, that was Marlon Brando's idea. Credit where it's due.
Yeah.
Bizarre, but true, yeah.
Yeah. So, I think it's, you know, it did set that standard. And whether, you know, someone coming to cinema and maybe their first movie was Man of Steel, maybe their first movie was Superman Returns, maybe their first Superman movie will be this one this year. But yeah. I think that they're all subconsciously influenced by this one.
Heavily. I mean, I'll get into it, because I, being that much of a nerd, I can kind of tell you some specifics. But before I do that, Sandy, did you have any thoughts without wanting to put words in your mouth about legacy and influence?
Just that it certainly was kind of first of its kind of movie, set the tone for others, and especially for Superman being very humble in his Clark Kent form. And other superheroes, maybe not in their alter ego, you know, like Bruce Wayne was a playboy, but Batman himself was very humble. So just kind of that underlying tone, which gave them to be part relatable and part out of this world superhero. Also that they're very self-sacrificing. I just definitely see that tone in all later films of this nature.
Awesome. Fair enough. Again, I can't underestimate just the impact and legacy this had on everything. Not only, as you said, the fact that it influenced Superman to the level that the Superboy TV series that followed and Smallville both very pointedly take this movie as their kind of show bible, I guess. This is what they're kind of riffing on. They're both prequels specifically to this. The comics, like you said, incorporated an awful lot of things from this, even before you got the actual Superman 78 comics that are set in this universe. And Lois and Clark owes this an awful lot. And as you said, the actors in this were specifically kind of turning up in other things. Christopher Reeve and Margot Kidder both turn up in Smallville as critical kind of pivotal roles to Clark's development, because that's the way the film is. And again, leaping slightly forward, John Williams' score turns up in almost every iteration of Superman. And again, Superman Returns, whatever you think of the movie, it's very deliberately, it's an exact sequel to Superman 1 and 2, which takes these as gospel and repeats beats and lines and everything from this movie. But outside of Superman, there's even greater influence. And I know that Sam Raimi has said that when he was tasked with making the Spider-Man films, he was very consciously aware of Superman, that it was his favorite movie, his favorite superhero. That's why there's a Superman reference in the very first Spider-Man film, by the way. But that's also how he approached that kind of the origin story, giving it that mythic kind of gravitas, giving the romance the importance, and making the superhero's story like the way that it is. Also, Wonder Woman is very heavily influenced by this. Patty Jenkins has actually admitted as much, which is also why you get the, again, exact homage of the scene where Diana and is getting mugged, and she basically deflects the bullets from the wrist rather than catching it Superman style. That scene exists because of Superman the movie, and an awful lot of that movie is played in, again, the same way, the origin, the kind of mythic importance, the outsider finding their way to the world. And yeah, she kind of said that level of verisimilitude and the way that the tone of that piece is was a strong influence on her. And again, we could be here all day listing other stuff. Those are the ones that I know people that are responsible have pointedly said this is definitely because of Superman. I'm sure there are others that haven't outright admitted it or that I haven't been aware of. But yeah, I definitely have to shout out those few that I know have been. And again, it goes to show the importance of this film. So Super quickly then, before, I have a couple of things, but first of all, you've kind of touched on it, but do you think there's any aspects of this that are missing or things that have dated poorly? Sandy, you kind of touched on it, so we'll come to you first, I think.
Yeah, some of the, you know, I never picked up on it before. I don't know why, but like after Superman saves the cat from the tree, and the girl
and the poor little girl getting slapped. Oh yeah,
I never.
You have to laugh, but it's so horrific.
It is
so weird.
That and Tessmacher stealing that kiss when Superman is unable to consent, but he didn't seem that stressed out by it.
Yeah,
it was all right. Just those types of things. I feel like a lot of the archetypes held up pretty well, actually, and the other effects weren't too terrible, but it does seem, I don't know if it ever felt like it could really happen, you know, things that Luthor had planned and done, but it doesn't feel very realistic at all that any of that stuff could have been pulled off in the way that it was. But that's really about the only thing, except for, you know, some minor, I think, unintentional things that were quite funny, like when the policemen were in the car chasing after the bad guys and they're shooting at each other and the officer that's driving is just shooting his pistol in the air for some reason.
Just some silly
things like that. But otherwise, I didn't pick up on too much, but just a few things certainly aged poorly.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think anything's ruinous to the movie, but I have to say I noticed the things you mentioned, but also I really dislike when Miss Tessmacher is like, well, I know I'm going to get wrapped in the mouth for asking this, because I'm like, oof. That's, I mean, I know Luthor's a villain and everything, but
and
still,
that is with two peas.
Yeah, exactly. And the other one being the Larry Hagman cameo. It's kind of nice to see JR in the movie, but how incredibly sexist that scene is.
Oh,
it's like, no, gentlemen, I'll give her the breast massage and the mouth to mouth. It's like, oh, come on, guys.
And then everybody turn around, about face.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. It's kind of iffy, but again, it doesn't ruin anything. So, DK, anything that you think about this, or do you think the gender roles maybe are a little bit sexist? I don't personally, but
I don't think the gender roles are sexist as such. But it's, you know, it is the '70s. It is the attitudes very much of the time. You've touched upon it with the Tessmacher thing, and you know, the little girl getting slapped and stuff like that. You know, everybody thinking that oh look, a pimp, cool. It is very much of that. It is very much of that time. It's so, you know, as far as that goes, it is showing it's, you know, it's getting a little rough around the edges to an extent. But it never does it to me to the point where it's completely off-putting. I mean, you can watch some movies from the 70s and it's just, good grief, what did I ever think about this? But I think essentially, it's, you know, attitudes of the period notwithstanding, I do think it still holds up quite well.
Couldn't agree more. So last thing then, let's deal with the elephant in the room. We talked about it off air a little bit, so the last thing with regards to the writing, the ending, the whole spinning the earth backwards to reverse time thing, you guys all right with it? Is it a step too far? Does it break the verisimilitude? Or, you know, what are your thoughts on it, DK?
I don't know.
Flash did it a couple of years ago, so.
Yeah, but let's not hold that up as a good standard of movie making. it's all right. It, at the end of the day, it's a comic book. And if you're going to, you know, obviously, if you're going to believe a man can fly, everything's on the table. I didn't mind that as such. I think the negative reaction I have to it is the whole scene beforehand where he finds Lois and he just gets really frustrated and upset. And I remember as a child feeling really uncomfortable at that scene because I didn't expect to see such emotion coming from Superman.
So,
oh, I love that. I mean, that's, again, that's become iconic. I mean, when
I get it now. I get it now, obviously. But as a kid, it made me feel incredibly uncomfortable. Looking at it now, it is hokey. It is, you know, this is ludicrous. But we're talking about a superhero thing here. This is never going to be a. This was never going to be a Christopher Nolan Batman thing. So I can deal with it.
Yeah, that's fair enough. I mean, yeah, but to your point, I mean, the epic, the blood-curdling scream of, like, grief that Christopher Reeve let out as begin, it's become so iconic that even in Smallville's 100th episode, when Lana Lang dies, spoiler alert, Tom Welling literally copied that exact sort of that acting and screamed in exactly the same way. So, yeah, did you have anything on the acting that you wanted to spit at us?
I do. As you mentioned earlier, or as I mentioned earlier, Robert Redford tested for this, as did Clint Eastwood and James Caan. They were all offered the movie's title role, and all three turned it down. Redford apparently wanted too much money. Eastwood said he was too busy, and Caan said, Mario Puzo wrote a hysterical script with Superman doing loop-de-loops and shit. Marlon called me, come on, do it too. I need some laughs. I said, yeah, but you don't have to wear the cape. No way I'm getting into that silly suit. Okay. Yeah, Christopher Reeve was an unknown actor at the time. The credits of nearly every trailer for this film list Brando and Hackman before Reeve, who played Superman. I think a similar thing happened later on with Jack Nicholson and Michael Keaton in Batman. Reeve also provided his voice for the air traffic controller, giving the arriving helicopter pilot the conditions. Initially, Gene Hackman refused to shave off his mustache to play Lex Luthor. In early one sheets of the movie, his face is featured with the mustache. Before Richard Donner and Hackman met face to face, Donner proposed to Hackman that if he would shave his mustache, Donner would shave his too. Hackman agreed. It turned out later that Donner did not have a mustache at all. Instead, he wore a false mustache that he peeled off at the last moment. And
I heard that story. I love that.
On his first day on the set, Brando suggested to Richard Donner that the cameras roll during rehearsal. Brando reportedly said, who knows, we might get lucky. According to Donner, that very first take was the one that was used in the finished film. Apparently, Brando was notoriously lazy and was constantly pulling little stunts like this to lessen his workload. Christopher Reeve later complained about it in interviews, saying Brando was phoning it in and it shows. And Paul Newman was offered the choice of playing either Superman, Luthor, or Jor-El for the fee of $4 million, and he wasn't interested in any single role. And finally, Sir Christopher Lee turned down the role of General Zod because he had just moved to Hollywood as a tax exile and did not want to return to England for filming.
Okay, fair enough. Well, both probably. I have a few things I wanted to add to that as well. First of all, Christopher Reeve was somewhat reluctant to take the role. He was worried that the role of Superman would not offer a, quote, genuine acting opportunity. He reasoned that there must be some difference stylistically between Clark and Superman. Quote, otherwise you just have a pair of glasses standing in for a character, and I don't think that's enough for a modern audience. The challenge for a performer was not only to balance the two characters, but also to project goodness without appearing hopelessly naive. And in this, I think Reeve was triumphant. He credited the script. He said, I found I was wrong about this material. I mean, my perceptions were wrong. Especially, he said, in the interplay with Lois Lane, Reeve saw something that I wouldn't want to miss, he said. I did see it as a chance to play a real character and to reinvent something for the time I was cast in. And yeah, credit where it's due. I think Superman and Clark are such different characters. Reeve is transformative in this. I cannot emphasize that enough. It is incredible how what he can do with no special effects or anything. It is just literally stooping to standing up straight, and it's incredible.
And you see it most, I know you're seeing that scene in your eye, but just to say it, you see it most in that scene where he's, you know, wondering if he should reveal himself to Lois while she's getting her sweater, and he's in the apartment and he takes off his glasses and he's about to reveal himself to her, and then rethinks it at the last moment, puts his glasses back on. And so you see that change between the two of them right there. It's just really, really fascinating and so extraordinary.
It's incredible. It's like magic to watch. It really is that good. And to your point about Brando, he apparently horrified Salkind by proposing in their first meeting that Jor-El appears as a green suitcase or a bagel with Brando's voice.
Yeah.
But Richard Donner used flattery to persuade the actor to portray Jor-El himself. as you said, he did not acquit himself well. Christopher Reeve was not a fan and would often go on chat shows and when asked would criticise Marlon Brando quite heavily. So, yeah. And in terms of the other actors, after Margot Kidder's sad death in 2018, critic Sonia Sireya of Vanity Fair retrospectively praised her ability to balance Lois's ditzy nature with her ambition and no-nonsense attitude, calling her a worthy foil to Reeve and writing that Kidder played a human woman who could believably both attract and deserve a man who is canonically perfect. And again, I could not agree more. So, yeah. So, yeah, I'm good. I don't really have any specific notes other than those things about the acting and the stuff that I've already mentioned. I think Kidder, I think, is a feminist icon. She's tough and she's no nonsense. And I think the idea that you can't be romantic and everything with that is a silly one. I've already mentioned, I think Christopher Reeve is just incredible. Not only is he the definitive Superman that I don't think has been bested or ever will be, but yeah, the transformation between his Superman and his Clark is just exceptional. It is. It's like watching magic just because. It's you're standing up straight, changing your voice a little, taking the glasses off, and it's a completely different character. And yeah, as you said, Gene Hackman's doing what he's expected to do, bringing the star power, but also selling comedy whilst also still not being a clown. So yeah, that's all I have to say is just praise for these guys. So throwing it open to you, who wants to go first and who wants to talk anything about the acting in the film?
I think everybody's pitch perfect in this. Even Brando, I mean, yeah, a fellow actor might recommend that they're phoning it in. But to us plebs, I still think he does a hell of a good.
I love it.
Yeah. Performance.
I love the Brando scenes. I think for me, it kind of goes to show how talented he was, and kind of the shame of it is that he obviously had so much natural talent that it adds so much gravitas and importance to those scenes, even when he's not trying.
Yeah, you know, you look at Susanna York and Valerie Perrine and Ned Beatty; they're all second stringers in this movie, but they're all really good. You know, Jackie Cooper. Even down to East, who plays a young Clark Kent, who apparently was really pissed that he was dubbed over. yeah, but he still does really good. I just think there's not a bad performance in this. Even down to like cameos, and when I say cameos, I mean like you know John Ratzenberger and yeah. stuff like that. It's they're all just great.
Yeah, Sandy.
I really, just. Superman, as far as him consenting to do this film and them choosing him, I just can't imagine. And I don't know which came first, right? Chicken or the egg, but I just can't imagine a better Superman just in his stature and the kindness in his eyes. His smile is still just like knocks you over. Just really the best I could imagine. He's got both kindness and strength and just exudes it. I can't imagine a better person. And for me, I thought everybody else was okay. And Ned Beatty, however you pronounce it, was really good too. But the standout for me was Gene Hackman. He was just so great and so full of energy. I just really loved his acting in this.
Awesome. Fair enough. Yeah, I have to say, I didn't write this down, but I have to say, I do know that the filmmakers were reluctant to hire Christopher Reeve because he didn't have what they kind of pictured as being Superman's sort of, you know, body type, shall we say. But Chris Reeves did, once he got the role, he trained with Dave Prowse, actually, the guy who played the physical form of Darth Vader, who taught him like bodybuilding and diet and exercise and everything and built up the muscles. So yeah, credit where it's due. And I think that again is something that has become so commonplace when you get cast in a superhero movie now that only really started with this movie, that, you know, the idea is that you've got to put in the effort and look the part. So yeah, fair enough. Moving on then, we'll move to the direction. Don't really have a lot. I have some potential talking points, but the one thing I did want to mention, because it's from the behind the scenes of this movie and it's always stuck in my mind, is just an example of directing genius, which is how they did the scene where they're returning from the flight with the Lois and Superman, and then Superman leaves the balcony, flies away, and Clark arrives at the door like milliseconds later. I don't know if you guys are aware of how they did that, but the way that it's done, and again, absolutely ingenious for 1978, the balcony itself is actually a screen where they're just back projecting Superman flying away. So Chris Reeve is never there. So he's actually in full Clark get up, ready to knock on the door. So I just think absolute genius.
Yeah, that is fascinating.
You know, long before they'd had to do techniques along these lines, and Richard Donner had the thought to be like, no, we'll, you know, we open the scene on that scene of the balcony, but we're not in there. You can use that as a rear projection you know, and then that looks like Superman's flying away and Clark arrives at the door. Brilliant. Love it.
This won't spoil it for you, but I did read that he used his knowledge as a pilot to kind of make it all look more believable, which I'm guessing is his kind of pivoting and turning when he changes directions. I'm guessing that's where he used that skill.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. And I think, yeah, I mean, whatever the technological limitations are, I think Donna overcame them personally. And again, you can't underestimate the importance of him as a director, but it pervades everything so much that we've already talked so much about him and how important he was to all these little things, you know, the iconic scenes, the way that they play out, the various rescues, as you said, the flight, the idea that you believe a man can fly, is it only works because of his direction. So, yeah, I mean, I don't want to seem blasé about it, but I don't think there's much else that we can get into really with Richard Donner, unless you guys can think of anything.
No, not really.
Cool. So we'll move to the VFX production design then, because there's a little bit about that that we could talk about. So yeah, the production design you already mentioned was by John Barry, who is the you might know him as the guy who does James Bond and Star Wars, and it was at Pinewood Studios in the UK, as you kind of hinted at. So yeah, I mean, when you think of the things that were invented for this movie, again, the idea that Krypton is a crystalline planet that uses crystals for, you know, data retrieval and everything. Obviously, this comes from the idea that the Fortress of Solitude was an ice palace in the comics, but had never been extended to the planet Krypton before. And this was, you know, whoever's idea it was, I think it's executed brilliantly. It looks gorgeous in this film. Would you guys agree with that?
It does look good. It does look good, yeah.
It does, especially the beginning, zeroing in on the planet Krypton and the dome, and then inside of that, you know, a crystal slash glass fortress there that they all lived in. I thought it looked really great.
Yeah, cool. And again, you can't really fault the way that Krypton's destruction's doing. I think it gives you that. I mean, it's 1978, so you're never going to get it looking, you know, modern level of disaster movie. But I think it works. It emotionally kind of hit me with impact, I think, anyway. And, as well as that, though, there's an awful lot of, like, miniatures, models, and map paintings, which if you kind of know filmmaking like, you know, some of us do, us nerds, you might spot some of them. But I think they work so much better than overabundance of CGI. And I'm talking like the Hoover Dam sequence, various things right in Metropolis. The fortress itself is an actual physical model. Do you guys agree that like having tangible stuff there is a bit more, I guess, it just adds that verisimilitude, I guess, that you don't necessarily get with CG?
I think so. I mean, yeah, some of them obviously do look like models, but it still has that physicality about it that you just don't get a lot of the time with CG. So I'll always be a proponent for this kind of thing.
Especially for that time. Yeah, I agree.
Oh, 100%, yeah, definitely. Cool. Right, so did you have anything about the VFX production design, BTS, DK, before I move along?
Yeah, the glowing effect of the clothing on Krypton, the wardrobe department, they spent weeks sewing tiny glass balls onto each actor's apparel. If the material was accidentally touched, the oils on the actor's hands would interfere with the lighting effect, leaving a dull patch on the costume. Yeah, the sequence of the helicopter falling off the roof, it took 6 months to film using 5 film units working in 2 countries. A man rode a motorcycle dragging a bag of dirt was used to make the effect of Clark running down the dirt road after jumping in front of the train. And to achieve the shot of young Clark kicking a football into orbit, an air cannon was placed underground and the football fired from it.
Wow, that's cool. Awesome. I like hearing about stuff like that. Yeah, the other thing I just wanted to mention before we move on from this then is that, again, in terms of influence and legacy of this film, the idea that the Phantom Zone would look from the outside like a diamond with the people screaming inside of it entirely comes from this movie and has been used in, I think, every depiction of the Phantom Zone since. Certainly Smallville, Supergirl, and I think maybe even the other films. I can't quite remember, but yeah, it's become fully iconic. And just as a random aside, I don't know if you guys have ever seen this, but it came up on my social media feed the other day that somebody had done this as a cosplay for a convention that 3 people had gotten together, one woman and 2 guys, and had, you know, kind of put black body stockings on their lower half and put a big triangle, like diamond shape over them. And they were just wandering around this convention, like pressed against this bit of cellophane as if they were trapped in the Phantom Zone. And it just looks so good. It's so cool. I don't envy them having to constantly be like right attached to each other basically all day. But again, I think it speaks to how iconic that imagery is from the start of this movie, that it's just become shorthand for what the Phantom Zone is. and I love it as well. I don't know why it doesn't necessarily make any logical sense, but it just looks cool. So, yeah. Awesome. Well, again, you're the music and sound guy, DK, so that would be our next section. All I have to say is basically what I already said for Jurassic Park, which is that this is another breathtaking and iconic John Williams score. And again, the highlight for me is the main Superman theme, which, again, it's part of our pop culture, and you hear it in every version of Superman pretty much as well. So,
yeah. It is like we were saying last week about Jurassic Park. It is iconic, and it's one of those unforgettable pieces of music that you will forever associate with these movies. But apparently Donna, he first asked Jerry Goldsmith to do the score, and Goldsmith agreed. However, a schedule conflict came about, and John Williams had to jump in. So Jerry Goldsmith didn't get his chance until 1984 Supergirl, poor guy. I think that was quite fortuitous, both for John Williams and the movie going public, because this is one of the few soundtrack CDs that I made sure to get a physical copy of.
Yeah, I can't blame you. I think, as I said, obviously there's the kind of heroic moments and everything in the film, particularly the main title, but also even the kind of comic Otis theme and stuff, they're iconic in their own way. And the romance scenes, the kind of music that's playing during the Clark and Lewis interview, and even, you know, that are playing behind the poem that Margot Kidder recites, love it or hate it. It's quite, you know, it's a good romantic sort of theme. And yeah, I love it all. It's great. And that's all there is to really say. So with that out of the way, then I'm going to move us to our next section. Well, before I do that, I'll ask, do you guys have anything else that we haven't talked about? Sorry, that you wanted to mention before we move on.
There is something I want to point out, and eagle-eyed people will spot it. The crooks that the cops are chasing that end up on the boat.
Yeah.
Oz Clark.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Go and have a look.
British wine connoisseur guy?
The British wine connoisseur and TV presenter is one of the criminals on that boat. Go back and watch it.
Wow. Oh, wow. I'm going to do that now. That's incredible. Awesome. Cool. Anything, Sandy, then, before I move us?
No, I was, though, going back and reading a little bit about the flying, and there was some interesting things that they came up with as far as the practical effects. One of the things they said, Les came up with this idea of making a remote-controlled rig out of an electric motor with fishing pole-like rods that would fit on Christopher's back, outlines Chilvers. Yeah. The rods, which were attached to the end of the cape, would flick up and down. Then, with a bit of wind as well, it really did sell the fact that the cape was flapping in the wind from the speed Superman was flying. Incidentally, Les also came up with the vibrator on the wires holding Christopher. If you could vibrate them enough, you wouldn't see the wires because of the way we were running the film at 24 frames per second. So I thought that was really interesting.
Awesome. Cool. Yeah, and like you, I had read that Christopher Reeve's experience as a pilot is also responsible for why it kind of, he did things like listing to the side a little bit and things like that, which really, I think, adds to the authenticity of the flight. So, yeah,
credit. And their tagline for the movie, "You'll believe a man can fly."
Absolutely. And I think we did. we never questioned it. When you think it's 1978, this is long before you could achieve that with CGI and whatever. So it is all, it's wires and clever camera techniques and things like that. And yeah, great job. So, yeah, moving to the next section then, which would be our critics' response. Again, I've been over this a few times now, but if you are not aware, this being a cinema classics, we don't tend to ask the audience response because we're looking at classic films, so it would usually be considered that we'd know what we'd get. But I'm always curious to see what critics made of these films, whether at the time or, you know, contemporary reviews. There's quite a lot about this, so I've split it into two sections so you don't have to just listen to one of us. And DK, I believe you have the start of the critics' response section.
I do, yeah. The Superman received mostly positive reviews from critics. The film was widely regarded as one of the top 10 films of 1978. Superman creators Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster, in tears, thanked Donner and gave a positive reaction. Shuster was delighted to see Superman on the screen. I got chills. Chris Reeve has just the right touch of humour. He really is Superman. Siegel beamed. It's exactly as I imagined it. Roger Ebert gave the film 4 out of 4 stars. Although describing the Krypton scenes as ponderous, Ebert wrote that Superman is a pure delight, a wondrous combination of all the old-fashioned things we never really get tired of. Adventure and romance, heroes and villains, earth-shaking special effects, and, you know what else? Wit.
He praised Reeves, stating that he sells the role. Wrong casting here could have sunk everything, and concluded that the film works so well because of its wit and its special effects. He placed the film on his 10 best list of 1978. He would later go on to place it on his great movies list. Gene Siskel of the Chicago Tribune gave the film 3 stars out of 4, calling it a delightful mess. Good performances, sloppy editing, cheap, non-flying special effects, funny dialogue. In sum, Superman is the kind of picture critics tear apart, but still say you ought to see it. James Howard of Variety, meanwhile, called the film a wonderful, chuckling, preposterously exciting fantasy. And he further added, as both the wholesome Man of Steel and his bumbling secret identity Clark Kent, Reeve is excellent. As newswoman Lois Lane, Kidder plays perfectly off both of his personalities, and her initial double entendre interview with Superman is wickedly coy, dancing around the obvious question any red-blooded girl might ask herself about such a magnificent prospect. Vincent Canby of the New York Times wrote in a mixed review, the Superman comic strip has been carefully, elaborately, sometimes wittily blown up for the big theatre screen, which, though busy, often seems sort of empty. He did, however, praise the performance of Kidder, calling her most charming.
Cool, yeah. So carrying on from that, writing in a retrospective review, James Berardinelli, sorry if I butchered that, believed, quote, there's no doubt that it's a flawed movie, but it's one of the most wonderfully entertaining flawed movies made during the 1970s. It's exactly what comic book fans hoped it would be. Neil Gabler similarly felt that the film focused too much on shallow comedy. He also argued that the film should have adhered more to the spirit of Mario Puzo's original script and referred to the first 3 Superman films collectively as simply puffed up TV episodes. That's the winner of our Hot Take Award for this week, I think. So, yeah. According to Rotten Tomatoes, 94% of 77 critics give Superman a positive review with an average rating of 8.1 out of 10. The critical consensus reads, Superman deftly blends humor and gravitas, taking advantage of the perfectly cast Reeve to craft a loving, nostalgic tribute to an American pop culture icon. Metacritic assigned the film a weighted average score of 82 out of 100 based on 21 critics, indicating universal acclaim. The film was ultimately a critical and financial success. Its worldwide box office earnings of $300 million made it the second highest grossing release of the year. It received praise for Reeve's performance and John Williams' musical score, and it was nominated for Best Film Editing, Best Music Original Score, and Best Sound at the 51st Academy Awards, and received a Special Achievement Academy Award for Visual Effects. Groundbreaking in its use of special effects in science fiction slash fantasy storytelling, the film's legacy presaged the mainstream popularity of Hollywood's superhero film franchises. And get your drinks ready, because in 2017, Superman was selected for preservation by the Library of Congress's National Film Registry as culturally, historically, or aesthetically significant. And frankly, it took way too long if it wasn't until 2017, but there you go. So, yeah, I think mostly pretty much positive reaction to Superman. So we'll swiftly move along as time kind of ticks away to what I like to do on my particular things, the cult classics and the silver screens, and ask for your favorite character moment and line in this movie, which I think is going to be trickier than usual when it comes to this, because there's a lot to like in this movie. Spoiler alert from my thoughts. So, yeah, we'll start with you, Sandy. Do you have a favorite character moment or scene and a line from this?
Like you said, it's really hard to narrow it down, but I think my most enjoyable moments come from Gene Hackman and his increasingly unhinged yelling out for Tesmaka. It was just so good each time, nice. And that's really my favorite.
Awesome. So is that your favorite? Which one of those are you applying?
Yeah, Tesmaka. Just that word.
So that's your favorite character Luthor moment, anytime,
and
the quote is just
end line.
Yep. Okay, cool. Well, that covers that then. So, what about you, DK?
Character, I've got to go for Reeve because he is pitch perfect in this. And to me, no, you know, and maybe it's the old guy talking, but nobody has come close to portraying Superman as good as Reeve did. So, yeah. Scene, it's got to be the helicopter scene. The whole "you've got me, who's got you" kind of thing. I just that is this movie wrapped up and exemplified for me. It's just it is that you will believe a man can fly, and it takes that, you know, incredulousness, and it is kind of a punch the air moment.
Yeah, fair enough.
Line, oh geez, yes. Out of all the speeches in this, out of all the profound things, out of everything that gets said, I shit you not,
my favorite line, and it's because of the way it's delivered, is, gee, are we going to Addis Ababa, Mr. Luthor?
Really? Yes. That's your favorite line?
It cracks me up every single time. The way Beatty delivers that, I freaking love it.
So my answers to this, obviously my favourite character is Superman, not just in this movie, but just in general in my life. If you know me at all, you know that I've got wealths of Superman merchandise, not just from this movie. But yeah, I have got film sales from this film. I've got books galore about Superman, comic books, action figures, way too many of them, Funko Pops and things. And I love Superman. He's the hero I always kind of aspire to, not necessarily be, but emulate. And it all started with this movie. This is the mythology, you know, that it was drilled into me from. So yeah, I have to go with Superman. And again, not just that character, but I think Christopher Reeve is not only the best cast Superman, I think it might be the best Hollywood casting of all time. I don't think you can get more perfect than that, and I think it's iconic for a reason. My favorite moment or scene is literally exactly the same as you, TK, so I don't have to get too far into that because it's for all the same reasons that you already said. So yeah, I love that helicopter rescue. There's a reason that again, Superman Returns just effectively rips it off with a plane. But yeah, it's such a great scene, and everyone's good in it. And it's, again, the special effects, the way that it comes together, it looks incredible even now. And my favorite line could have been anything that is spoken by Jor-El. In particular, I always kind of, I can't even think about that dialogue on Krypton without almost internally crying, just because it's so good and it resonates so much. But if I'm going to have to pick one line, it's going to not be from the Krypton scene, and it's going to be Jor-El saying, "They could be a great people, Kal-El, they wish to be. They only lack the light to show the way. For this reason, above all others, their capacity for good, I have sent them you, my only son." Anyway, moving on then, all that remains then is for us to give our conclusion and our scores out of 5 stars. So I'm probably going to have to go last because, as usual, I've written a small essay. So Sandy, we'll start with you as the guest.
I think this movie is very important in cinema history, and it is very iconic. And it's not for that reason alone, though, that it deserves accolades, because the practical effects and the way they used optical illusion to really make us believe, to bring something from a comic book to the screen and make it mainstream, is really just a class move. And the actors that they chose for it, the casting and how those actors fell into their roles and really brought it to life, along with the story. It's a very good story from start to finish. Very well put together, as you mentioned, mixing genres, but you don't even notice it. And for that reason, I would give this a 4.5 out of 5 stars.
4.5, fair enough. Okay. DK, did you want to go next?
Yeah, mine's only short. It's it's obviously a product of the 70s. It has its attitudes reflected in the production. It's beginning to show wear and tear around the edges a little. But honestly, it's not only is it one of the best superhero movies ever made, it's one of the best movies ever made. Reeve is fantastic. Hackman is fantastic. Kiddo is fantastic. Everybody's just doing a great job on this. I grew up with it. I can't say it's perfect anymore, but it's as close as it's going to get for me. So I'm going to also give it a 4.5.
Okay, fair enough. So let's see. Okay. So, yeah, again, sorry about the length of this, but it's a film that means a lot to me, so I had a lot to say. So, yeah, I've reviewed and rated this film in the past, and I've had to admit it's not quite perfect. Some of it is visibly dated, and my biggest bugbear was always the ending, one that I used to find too unrealistic and too at odds with the film's own commitment to verisimilitude. But you know what? That hang-up feels silly. This is a comic book sci-fi fantasy story, and more importantly, this film more than earns that one admittedly big suspension of disbelief. The more I reflect on it, the more I'm struck by how many visuals, lines, and ideas from this film have lived rent-free in my head since childhood, how they've helped shape who I am, and I'm not alone. So much of this film is iconic. There's a reason it remains the absolute benchmark, the template that's informed so much that came after Smallville, the Arrowverse, Wonder Woman, Spider-Man, and every single Superman adaptation since. Jor-El's words still resonate. Christopher Reeve is nothing short of transformative, absolutely nailing a dual role with subtlety and charisma. He and Margot Kidder have chemistry in spades. Even the villains, for all their theatricality, somehow fit perfectly, their antics both delightfully over the top and genuinely threatening, providing a real challenge to a hero so often seen as invincible. I could say more, but in the end, I have to let my heart rule my head. My inner critic is blinded by love. Is it perfect? Probably not. But is it beloved? So impactful, so formative that I can't bring myself to care? Absolutely. Not because it's flawless, but because it's foundational. The impact, the performances, the legacy all adds up to a film that still soars even decades later. Yeah, it's not perfect, but it matters. It has heart, heroism, legacy. It's still the gold standard. And if for nothing else, then for all those great talents that we've since lost, and especially for Christopher, who proved both on and off screen to me that heroes do exist. I give it 5 out of 5. And try not to cry.
Take a breath.
Flashing back to watching the documentary about Chris Reeve last year in the cinema and spending like an hour and a half just in tears. putting that together, yeah, absolutely. Putting that together and dividing by 3 to give us a final score gives Superman the movie a final score from us of 4.6 out of 5. So not too shabby, I think. And yeah, apologies for my emotional connection to these things. But yeah, this is the last of the 3 movies we'll have reviewed in a row that are, you know, 5 out of 5 foundational movies to my life. So we can now move on and you can all stop being annoyed by me. Anyway,
I mean, unlike our movie stars today, Christopher Reeve as a man never let us down his beginning to his end.
Not at all. And again, if you get a chance, I probably should have said this earlier, but if you do get a chance to check out Super/Man, the Chris Reeve story, the documentary that came out last year and I think is now on HBO Max, do check it out. It's fantastic. It's not necessarily as thorough as it could have been, but it is a great little sort of 90-minute documentary that touches on a lot of the things that that are important about Chris Reeve and his family. Anyway, moving on. And, that's going to do it for our review of Superman the movie, a film that didn't just leap tall buildings, but set the bar for every superhero epic that followed. It's grand, it's sincere, it's full of heart, and after all these years, it still makes me at least believe in truth, justice, and the magic of cinema. If you enjoyed this episode, don't forget to like, follow, rate, and review wherever you get your podcasts. It really does help us soar higher than a Kryptonian on a clear day. You can find us on all the socials using the handy link tree in our episode description, or just search Silver Screen Podcast, or wait for our outro, which will provide them there. Drop us a line if you have any feedback or there's a classic that you want us to cover in the future, and we'll, you know, we might do the best to do that. We'll be back soon with more cinematic legends, cult favorites, and maybe even a few guilty pleasures. Yeah, until then, I've been Michael. I just need to thank my intrepid co-host, DK. Thanks again, buddy.
Not a problem, dude.
And yeah, hopefully you've had a good time talking about Superman.
Yeah, it's been good.
And yeah, awesome. And Sandy, you've been fabulous, as always. Did you have a good time this one?
I did, but before leaving, I just wanted to give a shout out to the ballistic tracking map used by the military and Lex Luthor. Apparently, when Superman went back in time, he also ended up redrawing much of the U.S. state boundaries. And I have to say, Texas is much better off for it.
Fair enough. Wow. That's some deep cut, but awesome. And yeah, did you have anywhere that people could find you online, Sandy, or are you still just lurking around our Discord?
Still just the intrepid lurker.
Fair enough. And I know DK, you can just pretty much, if you want to get in touch with DK, you can just pretty much contact me and I'll do my best to forward a message. Is that right? Yeah,
that's pretty much it.
Cool. Yeah, so we're slowing things down a tiny bit right now as we focus on our sister project, Hit or Miss Star Trek. But we'll be back at the start of next month with a most triumphant cult movie and a Hitchcock suspense classic. Yeah, this has been Silver Screen Cinema Classics. Thanks for flying with us. And until next time. Oh, no, don't thank me, Warden. We're all part of the same team. Goodbye.
You have been listening to the Silver Screen Cinema Classics show, part of the Silver Screen podcast. Cinema Classics is hosted, produced, researched, scripted, and edited by Michael Wilson. Additional material by DK. Follow us on social media, our YouTube channel, or wherever else you get your podcasts. Links to all of these places can be found via the link tree in each episode's description. This podcast is a Media Matters original production created by Mike Wilson. Don't forget to like, subscribe, and share far and wide. Join us again next time, and hopefully this could be the beginning of a beautiful friendship. Here's looking at you, kid. Cut!